The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly, the Nations League. England beat the best team in the world and therefore are now the best team in the world by virtue of a dodgy penalty and a deflected goal. But what's the point of winning if Gareth Southgate doesn't pick the players you want him to pick? Elsewhere, we'll look back at three home nations penalty shootouts, the first ever for Northern Ireland and Scotland. The Scots follow it up with a shot on target on Sunday night that went in. Meanwhile, the COVID hit Irish are out of the Euros, but that gave them the freedom to express themselves in a thriller against Wales. We'll go big on that. There's some admin to get through. Pay-per-view football, would you stump up $14.95 for Fitbar Corner? And the big picture, an altruistic gesture from the biggest clubs in England to help the rest of us, or a cynical power grab during a global pandemic? It's probably that one. Don McRae joins us to talk about Arsene Wenger and to tell us how to interview people, all that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. And we have a panel today. Barry, a question for you. Can you recall Marcus Bean's only goal for Swansea?
No. I can't.
A question for Ellis James. Can you remember Marcus Bean's only goal for Swansea?
Yes, I can. Away at Rotherham in 2005, during a golden era when I didn't have a girlfriend and I used to do things like Rotherham away. Great days.
Were you there? You were there?
I think I was there, yeah. Mm. I mean, that season, I had nothing else to do, so I was home and away with Swansea. You only played a few times for the Swans, didn't you, Marcus? You were on loan from QPR.
Yeah, I was on loan there. Two loan spells, probably a total of about 20 games or 20, 30 games. 20 games, yeah, not long.
Same team as Trundle and Bayo. And
Trundle, Bayo, Liam Britton, yeah. Yeah.
Oh!
Yeah, it's a good team. It's a good team.
Great times.
I'm glad someone remembers the goal because I can't even remember it myself.
Well, I can't remember what it looked like. I just remember that side with great fondness. What was it like training with Lee Trundle?
He's one of the greatest players I've played with. Yeah, he's just what you see on a Saturday is what he does regularly in training. He's just got, he had so much ability. Yeah.
Oh, tell me about Liam Britton.
Brits is just the great, such a good guy, man. Unbelievably great technical gifted footballer, but just a really, really good guy. What you see is what you get. Smile on his face, good person. Yeah.
And also, I mean, obviously, Liam Britton, quite good for Swansea, but his career high point is during the Soccer AM Glory years being the host of Liam Britton's Got Talent, of course. which was a roaring success. Here's a question from Patrick. Why do people who don't like international football feel they have to constantly tell everyone they don't like international football and not just quietly get on with not liking international football, Ellis?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And it's that feeling of slight superiority, a bit like when you don't like the film that's won Best Picture at the Oscars. You go, well, actually, I saw that and I thought that some of the tropes in it were quite tired. And you think, oh, yeah, whatever. OK, you're great and you read Empire magazine and you've read one sentence on somebody's blog and that's the thing that you're going to say now about how that film is rubbish. I love international football. I would say that my love for international football has been tested over the last week. But the incredible smugness for people who think that, actually, if you put the Champions League best teams against the best international teams in the world, there would only be one winner. But I don't care. And that's not the reason I like international football. So stop going on about it.
And do you think Barry, the international breaks can be a bit disappointing, right? That, you know, especially after, if there's been a brilliant, you know, like we had the Villa 7, Liverpool 2 and the Spurs 6, United 1, and then we have this kind of barren week. But you can't have the major tournaments if you don't have the other international breaks, you know? You've got to do the exercise to get fit, that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm not sure that's the right analogy to give to you, but you see my point.
I don't have a problem with international football. I enjoy watching Ireland play, which, even though it can often be an ordeal, but I quite like a break from the Premier League every now and then. And, you know, I totally agree that people who don't like international football, you know, just enjoy the break. If you don't want to watch it, don't keep telling us about how much you don't like this. But I have no problem. From a professional point of view, it means more work because you have to do loads of research on teams you don't know a great deal about, but that's also interesting. You find out interesting little nuggets about various teams. So, yeah, I have no problem with it whatsoever.
Oh, give us a nugget, Barry.
Yesterday I learned that Scotland handed a debut to a 33-year-old defender from Aberdeen called Andrew Considine. And I saw him being interviewed about it. And the joy, he was so clearly overjoyed at getting this Scotland cap. It probably won't be his last because he played very well. But yeah, tell him that international football is boring. He was absolutely chuffed to bits.
I actually think the pathetic thing with international football is that it sort of brings out nationalism and tribalism, which I just think is absolutely pathetic. I actually like the game. I'm not interested in sort of these petty rivalries amongst countries and completely sort of arbitrary borders. I've never understood that. I actually think it's mentally weak to be international. Fuck you.
Hey, England are top of their group and they beat the best team in the world, Marcus. What did you make of that game? England were pretty bad, or Belgium were pretty good in the first half, but England turned it round.
Yeah, I thought there was improvement second half. I thought the approach was a little negative. We effectively had 8 defensive players on the pitch, if you count Mason Mount playing right wing, which he's not really accustomed to, he's a centre midfielder. And I think our weakness is in defence, so I understand why Southgate might want to shore it up, but at the end of the day, Belgium still created some very good opportunities. I think I'm a great believer in that attack is the best form of defence, and I'd like to see Southgate concentrate on our strengths, which is our attacking talent, and play maybe go with one in midfield, holding midfielder, and 2 more advanced attacking players ahead of him.
Were you then sort of sad that Grealish didn't play?
Yeah, Grealish needs to play in that midfield. I think he's the one that can knit the defence and attack. By that I mean he's a great ball carrier, gets us up the pitch, he can stay on the ball where everyone else is trying to offload it, you know, play 1 and 2 touch like the likes of Henderson and
Declan Rice,
sorry, thank yeah. you, yeah. He's the one that can knit everything together, and I'd like to see us with 2 more players, like him and maybe a Foden in the midfield, personally.
You know when they sort of say, you know, Grealish is really brave on the ball. Can you give us an idea of how difficult it is to want the ball in central midfield in tight spaces because you might lose it and that's not great?
Listen, I think if you lose a ball in your middle third of the pitch, especially how football's progressed, transition football, you're in big trouble, especially at the higher level. So players that can look after the ball in not just in their own, in the middle third, but also in your own defensive third and receive it anywhere is vital at the top level of the game, and he has the ability to receive it anywhere on the pitch because he's got such great awareness and also great feet. And for me, he's probably the only one in the England squad capable of doing that.
But we still beat Belgium. I mean, that's the point. I sort of feel for Southgate that because the first half was bad, you know, and maybe we shouldn't watch football and have social media on at the same time so you can make your own verdicts. But everyone's so sort of negative about England in the first half, and they turned it round. And I know, you know, Ellis, you would have seen how well Grealish played against Wales, but you have to give credit to Southgate for picking a team that beat Belgium, even if it didn't look beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And with Grealish, I worry that he is the new Matt Letizia or even the new Glenn Hoddle, and that he's going to be a fan's favourite who England supporters are desperate to get on the pitch, and yet he doesn't quite fit into this Gareth Southgate 3-4-3. And I don't know if his England's career or his international career is going to be a slight damp squib, bearing in mind the undoubted talent he has at his disposal. If he was Welsh, he would be guaranteed of having 150 caps, and that is what I always think when I see those players. If Matt Letizia had chosen Wales, He'd be making Robbie Keane look like some sort of inexperienced international footballer. But also, you know, Jack Grealish could have plausibly chosen Ireland.
Well, he did choose Ireland, and then he unchose Ireland.
So I don't know what will come of him. But what do you think, Max? I mean, surely you want to see him play. I mean, bearing in mind how good a player he is.
I suppose I wonder if we could play why can't you play a 4-3-3 and have him as the attacking midfielder with 2 behind him? That's what I think. And I look at Rice and Henderson and I think, like, I'd rather Calvin Phillips and one of Rice and Henderson because I think Phillips is better on the ball. But I don't understand why you couldn't play Grealish in the advanced three and still play Kane with Sterling and Rashford or Sterling and Sancho and have a back four. I don't know why we want to play a back three when, like, we don't have that many great centre-backs. Why don't we just have two instead of two average ones instead of three average ones? What do you think, yeah, Marcus?
I completely agree with you. I think we don't necessarily need Henderson and Rice holding. I think they both do very similar roles. Obviously, I kind of get why he did it against Belgium because he was obviously afraid of them attacking talent. But I just think it takes away so much from our attacking play. And we've got the likes of Rashford, Sterling, Sancho, Kane, Calvert-Lewin. They need to be fed. And the supply line would be greatly improved by having a Foden or a Grealish in that midfield.
Barry, Eric Dier gave away the penalty. It was a clumsy challenge. I want him to be really good. I can't work out if he's good. But is it worth pointing out that Romelu Lukaku is stunningly good at football? And sometimes when we watch these games, obviously you're a neutral in this game, but when I'm watching an England game, I sort of forget.
No, I'm not.
Okay, but I sort of forget there's an opposition. Like, even when I'm watching any game as a fan, I pay so little attention to the opposition, and so I'm sitting there going, oh, England are defending badly. But Lukaku was brilliant in that first half.
Yeah, well, he's a brilliant player. It just didn't quite work out for him at Manchester United, and sometimes that happens. Good player goes to a big club, it doesn't work out for him, but then he moved on and has been the player we all knew he was for Inter. I think Eric Dier is a reasonably decent player. He's not a world beater or anything, but, and it was a clumsy penalty to give away. If I could just talk about Southgate's team selection, I really think he's the wrong man for the England job. I think his pragmatism will be his undoing. I think he's just a terrific politician. He handles off-the-field incidents very well. He speaks great. He speaks very well. He talks proper. But I think in terms of selecting teams and making changes during games, he's not very unconvincing for me. And I think with him in charge, there's a grave danger of England squandering the huge amount of talent that's at their disposal.
Are you calling this a golden generation, Barry?
I think so, yeah. I think it's more golden generation than the original golden generation, but I suppose it would be, they'd have a better chance of emulating that golden generation if they actually got on the pitch. So I find it weird, and let's be honest, they were very lucky to win that game against Belgium. They got a penalty. I don't think it should have been awarded, and Mason Mount's goal took a sort of jammy deflection and went in, so I wouldn't read too much into the result, but yeah, a win is a win.
Richard Jolly saying Marcus Rashford, the first MBE to score a penalty for England since Harry Kane in 2019. Trippier played well at left back, but he's not a left back. A question from another Barry. How long until we have to resort to calling up Andy Hinchcliffe and Steve Guppy to cover England's problemed left side? The other thing I noticed is former Wigan player Sean Maloney on the Belgian coaching staff. It's not something I'd ever expect to see.
There's another nugget.
Yeah, there we are.
The kind of nugget you discover. I mean, the number of right-footed... Well, all the England players, I think, last night were right-footers.
Mm-hmm.
And an alarming number of them only seemed to use their left foot for standing on. You know, there was lots of... passing the ball side, cumbersome turns to pass the ball sideways or backwards. And again, just if I was an England fan, that's not what I would want to be seeing.
As an Ireland fan, come on. How many cumbersome Irish turns? I mean, there are buckets, aren't there?
Yeah, there are, but you're comparing apples and oranges there, okay, because Ireland have very, very limited resources compared to England.
No, that's a fair point. This victory followed up England's 3-0 win over Wales. How did you view that one, Ellis?
I hate playing England. I'm rational and reasonable enough to know that it was just a friendly and that it doesn't matter. And also, a weakened England team will always beat a weakened Wales team, if that's what's happening, and that is what happened on Thursday night. We don't play England very often. We've only played England, I think it was five times since 1984, up to Thursday night. And if we are going to play you and win, our best players need to be available. So there was no Gareth Bale, there was no Aaron Ramsey, there was no Joe Allen, there was no David Brooks, there was no Daniel James. And you're asking a lot then of fringe players to step into those roles and have the same sort of impact. I didn't actually think Wales played particularly badly. It was individuals switching off, goals from set pieces. They're things that can be worked on. Ryan Giggs clearly made his intentions obvious by saving players back for the Nations League games against Ireland and then Bulgaria on Wednesday night. So it's just disappointing because, you know, since the British Championships ended in 1984, we don't get to play our biggest rivals very often. And I'm not somebody who likes derby games. I don't like Swansea playing Cardiff. I don't like Carmarthen Town playing Llanelli. I've never really been comfortable in the derby situation. So to play a weekend team against England disappoints me on a kind of primal personal fan level, but you have to see it for what it is. And I think if Ryan Giggs has taken anything from that game, he'd have looked at Rabiu Matondo getting minutes, he'd have looked at Tyler Roberts getting minutes, and I'm sure that he will have thought it was a decent thought-provoking exercise. But it's just, I mean, the fact there were no fans in the ground made it far easier to cope with.
I mean, the fact there were no fans in the ground meant we could hear the national anthems, which was, it's absolute joy to hear, you know, quite how out of tune. I mean, I'm not an amazing singer, but as they go along and you can hear each individual one, it's a bit like the choir when they say, can you just sing that on your own? You're like, oh, no, not that bit.
I would say that I'm a bad singer, but I can sing the anthem. You think that's singing at its most basic. But so I don't know. I mean, it was we were looking forward to the Ireland game, really. The England game, I think when it was put in, the FAs of both countries expected there to be fans in the ground. One of the first games where there'd be fans in the ground and it'd be a slight money spinner. Obviously that didn't happen, and so the whole thing felt rather pointless. Our record against England since 1877 is absolutely dreadful. That hasn't changed.
Was it good before 1877?
We didn't win at Wembley until 1977, late in James' penalty. And it means I'm going to be watching my Wales 4 England 1 videos from May 1980 until we play the next time. But, you know, that's life. That's the life.
Marcus, Calvert-Lewin scored, which was great, and Danny Ings scored, and that was great, and Connor Cody scored, and Lars Siverton gave us this stat. He's had no shots since Wolves have been in the Premier League. Not a shot.
Wow. That is
He had one shot, I think, in the Championship and scored a penalty, and that was it. And like the joy in his face, Cody, when he scored was just marvellous, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was great, and he definitely seems like one of the players that the other players really respect and love. You could see that, you know, everyone was really happy for him when he scored. I'm a big fan of Connor Cody, especially in that middle sweeper role. I think he's excellent on the ball, obviously being previously being a midfielder, and he's someone, you know, we can start off attacks and maybe help us progress the ball out of the pitch a little bit better. So no, I'm really happy for him.
A lot of people say, you know, Connor Cody's good because he talks a lot. And I was like, surely everyone at that level is talking a lot. Like, have you played with people who are totally silent?
Yeah, I've played with a lot of people that are totally silent. You'd be surprised how many players don't talk on the football pitch. There's always in every squad, you know, there's only like, from my memory, just guessing, probably like four or five people that are very vocal. And then you get a lot of people that are very quiet and introvert. You know, it's just like in normal life, you know, you get different types of people and it's the same things on the football pitch.
What were you?
I was a talker. I wouldn't say I was a barker or really loud, but I was a talker. Yeah. Some people just like prefer to concentrate on their own game, and they feel like if they're talking, then it takes away from their own game.
And are the shouts in professional football, is it the same as like me just yelling don't let it bounce.
Man on, use it. Yeah. Yeah. Use it.
Feet. And do you have opposition players who go all day when you ping one over the bar? They don't effing want it. I mean, is it the same?
It's exactly the same. It's no different. Man. Let him shoot. That's one. Whenever I used to get the ball rolled back to me, he's like, let him shoot.
Because I just would have thought, it's a bit like those, Harry Kane team talks in the Tottenham documentary. I was expecting there to be something more at that level.
You taught to be more Churchillian, did you? I mean, I remember playing a game for Burr Town once. So I was left back, and the winger I was marking, anytime he went on a run up the flank, he kind of made a noise like a Grand Prix car's engine revving. As you know, it'd be like, and it really put me off. I'm just. Have you ever encountered that, Marcus?
It's great banter from the guy. Listen, I'd wish I'd encountered that. That would have cracked me up. That's good. That's good banter.
Anyway, you were saving your players for the Republic of Ireland game, Ellis. Dan says, I watched 4 international games over the weekend. Everyone finished 0-0. What's the point of anything? Lars said, watching Ireland-Wales caused me to fall asleep on the sofa and sleep through Erling Haaland's first international hat-trick. Explain yourself, Ellis and Barry. Charlie says, when did Ellis last watch a Wales game so boring? Barry, Ellis, you have as much time as you like to discuss that football match.
I like Ireland. I like the Irish. I like Dublin. I like Barry. I hate playing Ireland because it's like a spell. The Irish team have just got this knack of bringing out the worst in Wales and also in themselves. And the games are always horrific. We didn't play Ireland at all until 1960. Since 2013, we seem to have played them every fortnight or so. The games are always 0-0 or possibly 1-0. Apart from that aberration in Cardiff a few years ago when we beat Ireland 4-1. I would say that last night, or yesterday afternoon rather, is up there as one of the worst matches of football I've ever seen in my life. Wales Armenia from 2001 set a low bar, and I think that yesterday managed to beat it. And as I said, I always go whenever we play in Dublin. I always have fun in Dublin, great city. But my God, the football is stultifying. And it's always the same. It is always the same. What do you make of it, Barry?
Well, I found it quite encouraging yesterday, I have to say. Because the last few occasions Wales have played Ireland, and I remember one of Giggsy's first games in charge was against Ireland, and it was that 4-1. And I remember on your Feast of Football podcast, you, Danny Gabaldon, and Ewan got ridiculously carried away on the back of that performance.
When in fact, the world's best football team for about 20.
It was more Ireland's incredible badness that made you look good than anything you'd done yourselves. But generally, when we've played you in recent years, and like you say, it seems to happen every fortnight, we either play Wales or we play Denmark. We've been, sitting back, inviting pressure and lumping the ball long to Shane Long or Daryl Horgan or whoever happens to be up front on their own, toiling. And yesterday we tried something different, because under Stephen Kenny we are trying something different. And I thought it worked quite well. I was encouraged by it. Our finishing, again, leaves so much to be desired. I think we were the better side yesterday, despite the fact that, I say the signs were positive, and it was a positive result for Ireland. And Ireland have had a lot of positive results in recent days, meant we were missing in total yesterday 12 players through a combination of COVID, close contact and actual proper injuries. And I would say of those 12 players, 6-7 would probably have been in the first team. So it was, to all intents and purposes, a reserve side Ireland put out. And I was faintly encouraged by the manner in which they played.
I was discouraged by the fact that we just couldn't break down an Ireland team that had been ravaged by COVID-19. And the tempo of the game was so slow. And you just want Daniel James to take a player on. And every now and then there'd be a spark or a suggestion of something from him or Aaron Ramsey. And it just never clicked into gear. And it was a very, very frustrating watch.
Ireland had gone out on Thursday night on penalties to Slovakia. How painful was that, Barry?
It's disappointing. I'm not going to lose sleep over it. It happened. I think Stephen Kenny has had zero luck. I think it's four games he's been in charge now. He's just had no luck whatsoever. I kind of felt for him because it's not his fault we didn't win the penalty shootout. He was unlucky in that two players who could have taken penalties weren't involved in the game because they sat in the wrong seats on a bloody aeroplane and came into close contact with a backroom staff member who, you know, they shouldn't have come into contact with. So it's unfortunate. It smacks a little of carelessness, but I actually don't think Euro 2020 will happen, personally. If it does and we're not in it, then so be it. I won't mind. I'll be able to watch it and not have huge amounts of stress.
Well, Slovakia's win means they play Northern Ireland, who knocked Bosnia-Herzegovina out on penalties. Northern Ireland's first ever penalty shootout. Burnley's Bailey Peacock-Farrell made several important saves. With kind of, he's got ripped sleeves or like cut sleeves. They're not like sort of, they're not like neat Casillas like short sleeves. As you know, I don't trust any goalkeeper in short sleeves. What's good is they knocked Bosnia-Herzegovina out, but in the Nations League group that ended up with Northern Ireland knocking Bosnia-Herzegovina out on penalties, Bosnia won that group unbeaten with 10 points, and Northern Ireland came bottom with no points in that Nations League group. Yet somehow they get through. They then went on to lose 1-0 to Austria, and Slovakia leads us on to Scotland, beating Slovakia and getting a shot on target. Richard Jolly tweeted at halftime, "There's been one shot on target in the last 187 minutes of Scotland games. Scotland didn't have it." But they did score a goal. Fraser Elgin, "You could write the cumulative shot count in our games in binary," he says. Stuart said, "To be fair, I went to 6 Scotland away games before seeing a goal." You mentioned Andy Considine, Barry, and that was a really lovely story, wasn't it? And I tweeted that I was surprised Scotland had a shot on target and scored a goal, and I realised then it's Scotland fans are allowed to joke about how Scotland don't have any shots and don't score any goals. England fans are not allowed to make the same joke. Marcus, you saw a bit of this. What did you make of it?
I think that in Lyndon Dykes, they've got a striker who looks like he's very hungry for goals, works really hard, presses the ball, makes the right decisions in possession, and he makes good movement when the ball's coming into the box. So if you could supply him with crosses, the likes of Ryan Fraser, who looked like he had a good game and he's missed a lot of football, but looked sharp, and Robinson, again, we know is an expert at delivering assists, then, you know, there's bright future for Scotland if they can get those two players linking up with Dykes, who started the championship season off very well. So I thought it was quite good. I looked really impressive from set pieces, good delivery, players, you know, with good, great desire to try and get on the end of things. And I thought it was actually quite a good performance from Scotland overall.
And that followed up their victory over Israel on penalties to reach the playoff final, where they'll play Serbia to get into Euros. Their first penalty shootout ever, as well as the Northern Irish. Not a huge amount of fun away from those games. A hat-trick for Erling Braut Haaland for Norway as they beat Romania 4-0. Group A1 was my favourite. Bosnia-Herzegovina 0, Netherlands 0, Poland 0, Italy 0. So good. That'll do for part one. After the break, pay-per-view and the big picture. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. David says, how much are you going to charge for the pod in future? Two bits of admin here. We'll do pay-per-view before we do the big picture. The Premier League announced it on Friday, plans to screen closed-door matches on pay-per-view in an arrangement that will be reviewed at the end of October. Half the remaining games over the next 3 weeks will be shown on BT and Sky Sports pay-per-view platforms at $14.95 a match. On top of a standard subscription charge, for many fans, the cost of season tickets that have already been paid for. Top flight clubs voted 19-1 in favour of the scheme. Leicester City, the only ones to vote against it. Gary Neville said it was a really bad move. The Football Supporters Association said, "We'd urge BT and Sky to reconsider their pricing for these games. Many Premier League clubs have already taken money from fans, particularly season ticket holders, for matches they can't attend. We urge them to get refunds out to those supporters as soon as possible." Ellis, what do you make of it?
Well, it's too expensive for a kickoff, but because those games were free, it's very difficult to make people pay for something that has been free. And so I think they're going to struggle. I just think that £14.95 on top of... Sometimes you can be paying £90 if you've got Sky Sports and BT Sport as well. It just makes watching football so expensive and prohibitively so, and I just don't agree with it.
Marcus?
Yeah, I agree. I thought £5 to £6.99 would have been a fair price. £9.99 maximum, £14.95 is extortionate. I'm really interested to see if fans will buy games that they're not have no vested interest in at £14.95. I'm guessing they would have crunched the numbers and somehow believe they will, but I can't see it. I think at £5, then I would pay to watch Burnley v Wolves. At £14.95, you've got no chance. So for me, it just seems like that people are only going to buy, if any, the games, you know, the big games, the top six teams. And then even then, I think at £14.95, fans won't do that. So I think they've missed a big trick.
Yeah, and actually, there is a danger that because the big six are sort of on telly a lot, their fans won't have to pay. And so your Burnley fans, your Sheffield United fans, Southampton fans will have to stump up £14.95 a load more. I mean, I guess in principle, I don't have a problem with, you know, I pay for Sky and BT. You know, I know what those packages are. Five games at a weekend, that's sort of enough. I'm happy with the highlights for the rest of them. But also season ticket holders, they have to find a way. If people have bought season tickets, and it is different between different Premier League clubs, the way I follow works for EFL, if I'm right, is that, you know, you get refunded if you've got a season ticket. So that seems to be the model that they need to try and work.
I think the way the Swans were doing it, I don't have a season ticket at the Swans, is that you then got a code and you had access to the match, whereas I had to spend a tenner to watch it. And that makes perfect sense, that you're allowing season ticket holders to watch games that they otherwise would have been able to watch in more normal circumstances. I read in one of the papers that people saying, "Oh, that's too expensive, or that's too complicated to roll out across all of football." And I just thought, why? how is it too how is it too complicated? Because it, you know, I think you made this point already. But the idea that if you support Aston Villa, you've got to stump up more money than if you support a top six team is grossly unfair. So something needs to change.
The next bit of admin is the big picture. Matt says, "How will Max and Barry, very much the big two of the Guardian pod, go about getting the other podders to sign up to any reforms they came up with based on their own rampant self-interest? Would they threaten to leave and form a rival pod?" Oh, hang on, he says. Yeah, this was Sam Wallace's exclusive in The Telegraph. The details of the working document Revitalisation appears to be the work of John Henry, Liverpool's lead investor, and Joel Glazer, co-owner of Manchester United, with the help of Bruce Buck, the Chelsea chairman. No one's totally sure who's written every bit of it. Premier League goes from 20 to 18 clubs. League Cup, Community Shield, completely ditched. Remove equal voting rights in the top flight. At the moment, it's one vote per team. It's slightly complicated, but it would basically mean that the top six could vote anything if they all voted for it. 250 million quid present to the EFL, 100 million present to the FA, 25% of future revenue to the Football League. The Premier League said, in the Premier League's view, a number of individual proposals in the plan published today could have a damaging impact on the whole game. And we are disappointed to see that Rick Parry, chair of the EFL, has given his on-record support. According to The Athletic, the bottom 14 clubs in the Premier League were kept out of the loop on this and see it as a kind of hostile takeover. The government said, "We're surprised and disappointed that at a time of crisis, we've urged the top tiers of professional football to come together and finalise a deal to help lower league clubs. There appear to be backroom deals being cooked up that would create a closed shop at the very top of the game." Barry, you've read it. What do you make of it?
I'm not sure what I make of it yet. I mean, there is a lot to like in this proposal, and there is a lot to be very concerned about. I suppose you could look at it as kind of a turning English football off and turning it on again. And we have to bear in mind that we're looking at it from the perspective of being football fans, where the guys who've drawn up this plan are looking at it through the perspective of being businessmen. They're not particularly football fans. They're ostensibly in this for the money. So, of course, there's going to be self-interest. So, you know, if you look at what's to like about this proposal, the Premier League share 25% of future TV deals with the clubs lower down the pyramid. They provide $250 million up front to help out in the current crisis, money that's much needed. There'd be no more parachute payments, which would make the Championship and leagues below a more even playing field. And almost 10% of TV money would go to grassroots football and the National League and helping good causes. But then you've a lot of negatives as well, because the Big Six plus Everton, Southampton and West Ham, who seem to be being used as useful idiots in this scenario, they would have all the power. What would they do with this power? They would almost certainly wield it in a way that would serve their own self-interest. Other negatives, two teams from League Two would lose their league status. It smacks of the rich clubs taking advantage of the vulnerability of poorer clubs in a time of crisis. I think ultimately it's the Big Six having all the power that doesn't sit well with me the most, because if you look at in real life, if rich people's votes in a general election counted for more than poor people's votes, that would be an outrageous state of affairs. The whole thing about democracy is everyone's vote is the same, or is worth the same. But then I look at it and I think, if that was the situation in real life, where rich people's votes counted for more than poor people's, I don't think the government we have in place today would be any different. I have noted, I've been reading other people's reactions to this and the sort of the doyens of English broadsheet journalism, guys like Matt Dickinson, Ollie Holt, Matt Lawton, Henry Winter. They have been really strident in their opposition to this. And I can't see yet what it is they're so exercised about. I mean, this isn't set in stone. It's just a proposal and it can be tinkered with. I can understand why they're uncomfortable with it, but it hasn't made me as angry as it has made them.
Something needs to change and football needs a reset. What I find so worrying is the enshrining of top six elite status. In my lifetime, Nottingham Forest, Aston Villa, and probably Everton as well have been Europe's best teams. I watched a Premier League years the other day, and Georgie Thompson kept making reference to high-flying Bolton. You know, the top six is, you know, over the last 30 or 40 years has been very fluid, and that is part of what makes British football so great, or English football. You know, when the Swans got promoted to the First Division in 1981, I've got the South Wales Evening Post framed on my wall, and there's a great sentence where it says, "Next season, Swansea can expect the giants of English football, Liverpool, Man United and Ipswich on the fixture list." Now, that's not to denigrate Ipswich. They won the UEFA Cup. They came second in the league 2 years running. They were a really, really good team under Bobby Robson. But they're currently in League One. As it is, supporting a team that actually managed to make it into the Premier League less than 10 years after we were 45 minutes away from getting relegated from the Football League and then going on to win the League Cup. The League Cup is under threat as well. Now, if you ask Klopp or Guardiola or Pochettino, they would all say, "Oh, the League Cup is ridiculous, let's get rid of it." But when Swansea won it, that was one of the best days I've ever had in my life in football. And I'm sure that Birmingham City fans would say the same, and I'm sure that Middlesbrough fans would say the same, and it allowed us to play in Europe, just like it allowed Middlesbrough to play in Europe and go on that amazing run. The Community Shield, I mean, I don't think very many people would miss that. Although Courtois' penalty a couple of years ago, I mean, that, I find myself watching that on YouTube every now and then. But it's the enshrining of elite status in the six clubs that are the best six clubs at the moment is what I find uncomfortable. And also, I think there's an element of removing ambition from the middle tier of the Premier League and also telling newly promoted sides of the Premier League that they should know their place.
I also wonder sort of how in, you know, it's not enforceable. I mean, obviously these people are big hitters at the top of big football clubs. But like intrinsically, how massively different is this to like the four of us coming up with an idea and just publishing it and going, here's what we should do with football?
I think they probably would get more social media traction than we would.
but in terms of, like in reality, it's not their decision to make, is it, at the moment? I mean, they could...
Yeah.
The top six could walk away, I guess, from it, Marcus.
Well, I think the predicament of the EFL is kind of might force people's hands. I think the government, the incompetence of the government of not stepping in and somehow offering some sort of bailout. We should be really sitting at the negotiating table with the government, not the Premier League clubs. And I think that's forced everybody into a bit of a difficult situation. Ultimately, I don't think the deal's that bad, personally, looking at it. I think for most of the EFL clubs, it's a good deal, and I can understand why they'd look to do it. It's not great for anybody in the Premier League at the moment who's not in that top six, and Southampton and West Ham and Everton. If you're outside of that little cohort, then you're not going to be liking this. And also for the big championship teams who generally yo-yo up and down, it's not great for them either because they miss out on the partnership payments. But for everybody else, we're in a very difficult situation, and I don't think it's a bad deal. Obviously, there's a little few things I'd like to tweak. I'm not a big fan of the 15 loans. I'd actually go the other way if it was EFL clubs and demand, if we're going to do this, we want a cap on the amount of youth players. The Charity Shield can go in the bin because I'm not a big fan of that, but the League Cup, I think that's got to stay. And I also think there should be three teams should get relegated and no playoff between the third team, third bottom team in the Premier League and the third team in the Championship. I think we should just get rid of that. But apart from that, I don't think it's a bad deal.
Look, I'm minded to agree with you, Marcus. The other thing is, would they agree to that and not having their getting their, you know, voting rights, not changing the voting rights? If they said, yeah, actually, we'll do this all for everyone and it's a great idea, then brilliant. But if they have the power, the top six, then they could just easily take away the money. Or they could, that thing about vetoing other rich owners coming in is interesting, isn't it? Because then they say, oh, he's got loads of money, she's got loads of money, so we don't want them owning Bristol Rovers, because eventually they might come into the top six. Anyway, look, we'll obviously keep following that one, and that'll do for part two. Donald McRae will join us at the start of part three to tell us about his live online chat with Arsene Wenger. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. And now on Wednesday evening, Don McRae hosts an online conversation with Arsene Wenger for Guardian Live as Wenger publishes his autobiography, My Life in Red and White. Tickets are £6. Don joins us now to tell us all about it. How are you, Don?
I'm good. How are you, Max?
Yeah, really good. Very nice to meet you for the first time. Hopefully you can tell me how to interview people after after this bit. Tell us about the evening then.
Well, it's something I'm looking forward to particularly. You know, I've been doing the Guardian interview slot for 17 years now, and Arsene Wenger has been top of that pile for all 17 years. It helps that I'm an Arsenal fan, but I think Wenger is just a fascinating individual. Amazing to think that when he joined Arsenal in 1996, he was only the fourth overseas manager to enter English football. And I think most of us would agree that he just had a seismic influence on the game. And I think it's going to be a fascinating opportunity to talk to him and just reflect with him on his achievements, his failures. And he's quite an expansive guy. So I'm hoping it's going to be a fascinating evening.
In my limited experience of Wenger being in his company, he's one of those people who he doesn't waste a word, does he? Like every word matters, as in stark contrast, I'd say, to most of this podcast.
And me as well, definitely. He's obviously highly intelligent, obviously can speak many languages. And for me, I've always been, you know, kind of bemused a little by Wenger, because for all his intelligence, his culture, he's got this burning mania inside him. He's just obviously obsessed with football, and he absolutely hates to lose. So I think there's sort of this dichotomy in Wenger, and I'm hoping on Wednesday evening he'll explore this a little in more depth with us. But yes, definitely, he's such an articulate, intelligent man, and I think he'll have a lot to say about football in the past and especially about football now.
Were you part of the Wenger out brigade, Don?
Towards the end, certainly the last 18 months to 2 years, I felt it was time for him to go. But yeah, I wasn't sort of paying any money towards any of those planes that were flying overhead saying Wenger out. I felt it was quite poignant that a man who had done so much for Arsenal, there was such vehemence towards him at the end. Of course, people have softened towards him now, but I think just to talk to Arsene about those last couple of years will be quite illuminating. And I'd like to know whether he felt he should have left perhaps 4 or 5 years before.
Do you know what his feelings about Arsenal fan TV are?
I know, Arsenal fan TV, I'm sure they'll be flying in with some questions. But yeah, I'm sure if they met Arsene face to face, they would be much more respectful towards him.
Also, Don, he's got this new role at FIFA, head of global football development. And that is fascinating. You know, given kind of what a sort of pure, wonderful man he appears and how we generally feel about FIFA.
FIFA, I know. Gosh, how these two get together. And although I think the focus of the evening will be more on him as a football manager, certainly I think it's important that we hear how he's fitting into FIFA, what he's, because I don't actually know, do you, Max, what he's actually doing at FIFA? I mean, well, I haven't actually...
I mean, head of global football development is unlike FIFA to have a vague title for something. I read the other day that he was thinking about changing the throw-in to a kick-in, and I was like, he's taken some FIFA medicine here.
I know. Well, we'll certainly ask him about that. And but just in the memoir, he talks about still being obsessed with football. He'll still watch 3 to 4 games a day. He said he's become a bit more balanced. Occasionally, he will go out for a meal with his daughter. Whereas he said for the first 22 years of her life, that was just an impossibility because he was just consumed by football. And I often wondered, you know, how is he filling this void? And FIFA maybe is helping him a little bit. But I think his ethics are without question. So hopefully he can cleanse FIFA a little bit.
All right, so it is Guardian Live. It's on Wednesday evening, £6. We'll tweet out the link to this and we'll put it on the pod page. And I imagine if you just Google Guardian Live, Arsene Wenger, Don McRae, you'll find it. Thanks for coming on, Don. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Max. Speak soon.
Don McRae there. We'll tweet out all the details to that. Ellis, I got a message from Chris Martin, the comedian. Who said, you mentioned Max being asked to attend a bar mitzvah earlier and refusing to go because despite the money you were offered, it just felt awkward. Please ask Ellis about the time he did his first paid gig ever at a wedding in Wales. He was supposed to do 30 minutes. It's one of the funniest bad gig story you'll ever hear. Are you prepared to tell us?
It's quite a long story, but I was paid £80 and I'd only done about 20 gigs. And I hadn't brought my mic because that's not something that usually happens. So I went up to the DJ and I said, could I use your mic, please, and do some comedy? And he went, have you got performer's liability insurance? And I said, no. And he went, right, what if an old lady walks across my mic lead, falls down, breaks a hip and sues me for £1 million? Do I look like I've got £1 million to give away? And he had a baseball cap with clappy hands on it. I said no. And he went, right, so in that scenario, what's going on? Who is paying the £1 million in this scenario? And I said there must be 50 feet between me and the front row. The gig is unplayable. I said, if an old lady is walking towards me, I'm going to get probably 2 or 3 minutes notice to pull the mic lead away from her. It's going to be fine. And he wouldn't. In the end, I lied because I could see my £80 appearing. I lied and I told him that my dad was a multi-millionaire and that he would pay the money. And he believed me, amazingly. Anyway, did the show, died on my arse. Lasted probably 2.5 minutes before I realised that it was going so badly. It was unsalvageable. I escaped I walked into the first door I could see, which I hadn't realised was the kitchen of the hotel. So I just sort of stood in the kitchen for a couple of minutes with my head in my hands. And the father of the bride came in and he said, whoa, what the bloody hell was that? And I said, I'm sorry. And he said, have you ever done Penland Social Club? I said, no, I haven't. Have you ever done Dunvant Social Club? I said, no, I haven't. Have you ever done Landor Social Club? I said, no, I haven't. I said, I'm on a different circuit. And he went, oh, the not being very funny circuit, is it? And I said, yeah, I'm on that circuit. And he went, look at that. I've got an envelope there, £80 comedian. Do you think that was comedy? I said, no, it wasn't comedy. It wasn't comedy. And he took out £20 and he gave me £20 for petrol. And he put his arm around me. He said, I'm an honest man. I'll give you money for petrol. But as I said, I'm an honest bloke. And that was rubbish. You've got a lot of thinking to do. And I said, yeah, I apologise. And as I walked back to the car, the bride's elderly relatives kept coming up to me and asking me to explain some of the jokes I'd been trying to tell, because they were like, Where's the funny in that? I said, don't worry about it. It's, as I said, I'm on a different circuit. It's not important. So yeah, that was in 2005, and I will not be doing any weddings anytime soon.
Oh, that's lovely. Russ says, would Marcus consider signing with Everton to play right back so they could field an assonant back four of Dina, Keane, Mina, and Bean? And Louis says, it crossed my mind today with more working from home in 2020. Is it possible to get an update on how often Barry Glendening washes his hair?
Well, I've sort of shaved all my hair off, so I'm rocking a buzz cut these days, which I haven't attempted to put shampoo in it, because I'm not sure there's enough hair there for the shampoo to gain traction, if you know what I mean. So not washing it at all.
Okay. Any water on it? Are you wetting it?
Oh, yeah, water, but not... Okay. It's getting wet every day in the shower, but just no soap products.
Okay. Do you wash any part of you?
Yes.
Okay.
All of me, apart from the hair on my head.
It's very good to know.
I even scrub the soles of my feet with a long sort of brush thing.
A what? Excuse me? What, like a brush on a pole?
Well, I think it's for sort of scrubbing your back.
Okay.
So I use that to do the soles of my feet every morning.
Every morning?
Yes.
They're red raw.
That's amazing. You must have the cleanest, the in the sort of ratio of clean feet to clean hair, you must have the widest ratio on earth.
Well, if you think about it, like my feet spend all day wrapped in cotton and stuck in a sweaty trainer. They're probably the dirtiest part of my body.
Well,
so what's that supposed to mean?
I was just making a noise, Barry.
Okay.
Do you want the pod to end now?
Yes, okay. I'd quite like the pod to end.
Maybe if we did merchandise, we could have the Barry Glendening foot sole broom on a pole. I think that could sell well. About time.
Maybe.
Tomorrow, we're doing a special on the dangers of gambling. That seems quite a stretch from Barry scratching the soles of his feet. But that's what we're doing. And that'll be me, Barry, Philippe, and a selection of guests as well. So join us for that. Ellis, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Cheers, Marcus.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers, Baz.
Thank you.
See you tomorrow.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.